Welcome to the Baseball America Podcast. Baseball America, bringing you baseball news you can't get anywhere else for more than 35 years. Now it's time to talk baseball.
Hey, welcome everyone to a Baseball America Podcast. I'm John Manuel, joined by J.J. Cooper and Matt Eddy today. Continuing our organization top 10s. We finished the American League. We started on a raucous National League note yesterday with a loud, I was channeling Chris Russo talking Marlins. I don't think Chris Russo has ever gotten that worked up over the Marlins, so it was a little embarrassing to get as worked up as Chris Russo. So we're going to try to bring it down a notch today, but we'll have a lot of passion about the Mets today as we talk Mets top 30 and top 10 with our own Matt Eddy, who's been ranking Mets prospects for a long time, and has been ranking prospects for us at Baseball America. And also, Matt, I think it's important to point out, you only do one top 30 in the Prospect Handbook anymore. That's because you're the main editor of the Prospect Handbook now. You're the organizer. You read all 30 chapters. So kudos to you on taking on that larger role and being the main editor of the Prospect Handbook. How good does it feel to have that in your rear view?
Very good. It's our best product, and it's, you know, take pride in being a part of that.
Absolutely, you should. And the Prospect Handbook is available at store.baseballamerica.com. Order it now. Get the book directly from us. That's the way to get the book quickest. And you get extra report for all 30 teams. So you get 930 scouting reports with the extra supplement if you directly order from Baseball America and baseballamerica.com.
And if we said, when we say quickest, we don't mean you're going to get it a day before you got it if you ordered on Amazon.
Like a month.
We're talking a month. We're talking you get it, you know, before you get ready for spring training instead of it's arriving as you're talking about spring training.
We want you in our environment. We want you in our ecosystem. So order it directly. And you can also, if you don't want to go online and order it, 800-845-2726 is the way to order it over the phone. Matt, the Mets have been pretty successful over the time you've been reviewing their prospects at developing homegrown players. That's a key reason why they won the National League pennant in 2015. Homegrown pitchers, some key bats like Wilmer Flores and Michael Conforto. And right now we look at the Mets system and the strength, and one of the reasons that the Mets have a pretty decent farm system is they have two hitting prospects who were young for AA, who both reached AA. One spent the whole year there. One reached it in Amed Rosario and Dominic Smith. Nice 1-2 punch at the top of this system. Both these guys seem like they are ready to be regulars at the latest. I would say 2018, I expect both these guys to be regulars in Queens. Have the Mets had that in the recent past with two position players that close to the big leagues and that accomplished? And how do you rate these two guys in against the backdrop of other recent Mets top 30s you've done?
Well, the gold standard will always be David Wright, Jose Reyes, debuting in 2003 and 2004.
That's pretty awesome.
And Lasdin Milic right on their heels.
But that was my time.
And Scott Kazmir. Oh,
that was back of my time doing the Mets list.
So 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
But yeah, Wright and Reyes, I think, will always be the gold standard. I don't think this duo will reach those heights because Wright was on a Hall of Fame trajectory before his back and his health betrayed him.
Yeah. I'd agree.
But these guys are good. Rosario, in particular, is an impact shortstop. He does everything well except hit home runs. And I think
that's okay.
And the Mets are pretty optimistic that he can get to average.
Power.
At least average power. Which now we're talking 10 to 12 home runs.
Yeah, I mean, like, you've written extensively about this. I know that you and JJ have talked about this a lot. You got to have at least fringe average power to be a big league regular. I think there were questions about Amed Rosario's bat coming into this year.
As well as should have been.
And he certainly answered them, though, it seems like, in 2016. I mean, it's small sample size in AA, so 341 in 54 games. You know, you do take that a little bit with a grain of salt. But ultimately, what kind of offensive production do you think he can provide as an everyday regular in New York? Could he be as good offensively as, say, an Asdrubal Cabrera has been at his peak? Not say in 2016, but like a good Asdrubal Cabrera season, like a 15 home run kind of guy, and this is, in my mind, clearly a superior defender to Asdrubal Cabrera.
I think the realistic offensive ceiling is the shape of his production will be more like Elvis Andrus.
Mm-hmm.
As a speed-oriented, defense-oriented, not huge power, but a good offensive player. No silver slugger, but...
Right, and like Elvis Andrus, I think actually has a little bit of a bad rap. I do think that Amed Rosario has a little bit more pop than Elvis Andrus has had over his career, but Elvis finally came into his power. Feels like Amed Rosario, having talked about him in the Florida State League the last 2 years, there's a little whippiness to his swing. He doesn't maybe have the the body, like the strength that you see with Elvis Andrus now that he finally came into some power. This guy is fairly selective, does have speed, like you said, but it feels like this guy's going to drive the ball to the gaps fairly consistently.
The Mets are confident that that's true, and I would not be surprised.
I think a much more divisive guy, JJ, and a guy that we've discussed for the last couple of years, maybe 3 years really, is Dominic Smith. Like Ahmed Rosario is just, there are a lot of big leaguers like Ahmed Rosario. Latin American shortstops who are athletic, have pretty good tools, and that power might be the fifth best tool for them. There are a lot of guys like that. There are not a lot of first-round pick high school first basemen
period,
who are bad body guys like Dom Smith is. He is divisive within our own office. I don't think there's any other way to put it. We have Dom Smith guys, and we have non-Dom Smith guys in this office. He's a split. I think when you talk to scouts, JJ, and obviously Matt, follow up on this, but he's a split camp guy with scouts, is he not?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, there are things that Dominic Smith, there's a pretty much across the board consensus that he does well. For a big guy, there has been across the board consensus. He is at first base. This is a guy who knows how to pick it. And
really good hands.
Really good hands, and those play really well at first base. Now, you get a little debate about how much range he has, but again, when you talk about a first baseman, what is the defensively, what's the first requirement? How good are your hands? Because mm-hmm. can you scoop it? Can you, all that? He's really good at that.
He's Terminator X-like. I mean, Terminator X's best tool was his hands. This guy's got great hands.
But then I think there's also pretty much consensus that you are talking about a guy who's going to hit for average. He's always been able to hit. He hits for average. That part, okay, we've covered what is the consensus.
We've covered
agreement.
The known knowns.
When it comes down to it, is last year was encouraging as far as the power, but there still is a lot of debate out there about, is this a guy who's going to hit for enough power? We were talking about Ahmed Rosario. Now, the thing about it is that if you said what position can you be a sub 45 power guy and be a regular, it's shortstop.
Right.
Absolutely. First base, generally you're looking for 60 power. And that's the question is okay, not that is Dominic Smith going to be a big leaguer, because Dominic Smith's going to be a big leaguer. But that range, there's a very fine line there between the guys. There's not many guys who pull off the hit over power first base profile.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a lot of them that do end up being really more kind of second division than first division. I think of James Loney. James Loney's had a long career.
Right.
And James Loney is every bit as good defensively. I mean, that was always kind of his rep kind of as well. I mean, he's better body guy. But James Loney, if you talk about James Loney's a long career, but when has James Loney been a first division regular first baseman?
I mean, he had some decent years where he was with the Dodgers and they were a first division team. It wasn't because James Loney was a driving force. He was a nice part of that team, but he was a 6 or 7 hole hitter. That's generally, to me, Matt, the physical comp big leaguer for Dom Smith is Yonder Alonso.
Yeah.
And they're similar type players in that they're short.
Mm-hmm. Dom Smith is listed 6 foot.
Yeah, Yonder's 6'1". Thick-bodied
mm-hmm.
and hit overpower guys. That was their reputation. And Yonder Alonso has played now parts of 7 years in the major leagues. Wow. And has never hit double-digit home runs. So he's the floor. That's the definition of a second-division first baseman. His career high in home runs is 9. And he had a 2012 for the Padres, or this year for the A's, he had 253, 316, 367. Like last year, peak age 28 for the Padres, 282, 361, 381. That's the absolute floor. And I think Dom Smith's track record is a little better in the minor leagues than Yonder Alonso's was. Can he be a better player than that? Can he be from the Brandon Belt, Eric Hosmer school, where those guys were hit over power, but they've come into some home run power? Or is he going to be one of these guys who learns like an early career Jim Thome did? I'm not saying he's going to hit 600 home runs, but early career Jim Thome was hit over power
mm-hmm.
and then learned, boy, I know when I can really turn on one
yeah.
and develop into a guy who sacrifices average. Anthony Rizzo did the same thing. who sacrifices batting average for power. Anthony Rizzo has actually managed to do both.
But we've seen Smith do that in the minor leagues, going from one home run in his debut to X in year two into 14 this year. But this year really encapsulated the kind of the dual sides. In the first half, he hit for power like he never had as a pro. And in the second, he hit 350.
Right.
So, I mean, I think ultimately we're looking at a 60 hitter with 55 power.
So that's a good player. That's an optimistic, realistic.
With a plus glove at first base.
That's optimistic and realistic, I think, for Dominic Smith. Because like you said,
that's a top 100, and he was last year. I mean, we're talking about a top 100 prospect. I mean, this is not a guy, when we say...
But I don't think he's an elite prospect. I've seen elsewhere, this is like a top 30, top 50 guy for some people. Not for me. I don't think there's anything that
tells
you... He
didn't make any of our top 50s in the handbook.
And I just don't see the case for Dom Smith as elite prospect. I like what he does. I just think you have to double project or project a full grade to really say he's an impact bat at first base. You either have to project him as a 7 hitter,
mm-hmm.
or you're projecting him to be like a 6 power guy. Have you found any scouts who've done that?
The tenor from scouts has improved. You know, I think they were able to look past some of the biases.
Because he doesn't look the part.
No, soft physique. He doesn't seem super motivated on the field during pregame workouts.
Low energy scouts
hate that.
He's got a little Jeb Bush in him.
That's low energy. But that's where scouts, I mean, like multiple scouts, multiple teams, the first thing they talk about.
Lazy is the word that I've heard.
The first thing they talk about is they, again, we're talking about not in game. We're really talking about pregame routine and all. And they're like, He's a slow twitch guy anyway, generally, but they want to see more energy. They want to see more, and again, maybe they're focusing on things. I mean, that's not Dominic Smith, but maybe they're focusing on things that really, in the end of the day, don't matter that much because we are talking about a guy. It was a very good year he had last year, but at the same time,
he got better as the year went on, like Matt said. And that usually, a guy who's a low energy guy, you're wondering about his motivation. You're wondering about like. Is he athletic enough to do this? He seems like he's done it.
But
he's
grinded
it out every
year. But you know
what
we're talking about? Like, it's the funny thing is we just did an Astros podcast, John. And when we talked about, you know, when we talk about Colin Moran, you hear a lot of the same things.
Yes, you do.
And you hear about, I mean, the funny thing is making a Colin Moran Dominic Smith comp is a very strange because they are very different players.
Hey, if Dom Smith threw right-handed, I guarantee you he'd play third base, not first. Because he's got good feet. When he was in high school, everyone talked about this was a guy who could play shortstop if he threw right-handed. No, wait, now. There are no 6'250 first base shortstops. But if he threw right-handed, couldn't you see him playing third base?
The Mets said he actually wanted to play catcher after they first signed him, but he throws left-handed.
It's a catcher body.
I do always love that.
So
you can't catch. Throw left-handed.
So you're comping him to Mike Squires now.
And you hear the same thing from scouts talking about Colin Moran that you do about Dominic Smith. Low energy.
Yes.
I want to see more fire out of him. And then the second part, when you go to the actual grading it out, the concern, Colin Moran, he could hit.
Right.
He's going to hit. Now, I'll say this for Dominic Smith. Dominic Smith has hit at a younger age at every level, and he walks where Colin Moran does not.
Mm-hmm.
But the same concern about the power.
Like, I love the comp. Smith, I think that's inspired.
Smith has improved his strikeout rate and isolated power each season.
That's why I like Dom Smith. I do like the makeup. We've talked to this kid. We've had him on a podcast last year. We've had him in the Futures games. In person, he does have energy. He's a high-energy guy in person. He's always smiling. I bet he's a great teammate. I know my reports on him last year in the Florida State League were very positive from a teammate standpoint. Coaches like him. Scouts outside the organization have to get past that his look in BP and in and out. He just doesn't give you a good look. And like you said, the soft physique, not a good look for him. Our information is he's working on that this offseason. Mm-hmm. I now make him sound like a Mike Myers character, middle-aged man. Are you looking at my gut? I'm working on it. Remember that guy? I have turned into that guy. But the telling thing for me is the improvement year to year continues for him. And that's important. Mm-hmm. I do think he's always getting into a lot of double plays. Doesn't run well. Mm-hmm. Not a guy who's a elevate guy. He's a swing plane. He's going to hit a lot of ground balls. I think he can be a solid average to above average big league first baseman and a better player than Lucas Duda. But to use the Duda line. But I don't think he's going to be a star.
Yeah, what's interesting about what you mentioned there is Duda and Astrobel Cabrera are free agents after this season. So the deck will be clear in 18 for Rosario and Smith.
Interesting.
And the interesting thing with that is that this is the Mets team. This is the Mets team now that I feel like that's perfectly timed in some ways. In that, going bigger picture for just a minute, when you look at the NL East and you look at where the Mets are, I mean, clearly they're aiming to contend in 2017, but it does strike me, we kind of have, it's probably not fair to call it an end date on the Nationals, but we have some significant things looming with the Nationals, obviously. Most importantly, Bryce Harper becoming a free agent. I feel like this Mets team, this could be a relatively lengthy window, especially if guys like Rosario and Smith kind of transition in. If Michael Conforto is, you know, can basically put last year behind him.
Right.
And, you know,
and Wilmer Flores had a quiet breakthrough year, I think, especially in the second half.
But I feel like this is kind of a, you know, I feel like these guys are kind of a key to this being a long window for the Mets. Not, well, they had a great, you know, they made it to the World Series, you know, and now they hung around a little bit. This is, I feel like the future's still pretty bright here.
Yeah, one thing looking at the Mets system, I agree with you. They have a lot of range of inventory. Like, they have prospects pretty much all over the diamond, you know, up the middle. Catcher, center field, pitching. The pitching depth is thinned, obviously, because they've graduated multiple frontline starters. But they addressed that a little bit with Justin Dunn. Robert Gsellman is ready to pitch 150 innings.
Pretty important, I think. Robert Gsellman is a guy who's become a very important pitcher for the Mets. I want to get back to him in a minute. I did want to kind of, I don't know if I'd say round up the upper-level guys, but you do have two guys who've, there's probably a little prospect fatigue with Cecchini and Brandon Nimmo, future Team Italy stars for 2017 WBC. But Brandon Nimmo, your natural Wyoming Italian, and Gavin Cecchini. These two guys have 50 grades in the book, 50 medium grades. They are not risky, but doesn't it seem like either of these guys are going to fulfill the ceilings that you'd like, Matt, when you're picking these guys in the first dozen picks? Was it Nimmo? Where was Nimmo? 15th
11,
overall? Okay, 11th overall.
Yeah.
And Cecchini was 12.
Yes.
But let's look at what they can do. We know by now what they can't do, because there were 2011 and 2012 high school picks. If they were going to be stars, they'd been in the big leagues by now. But they're both going to be contributors. What role will they play in 2017 and beyond?
There's not really a spot for Nimmo at this point, because they have so many left-handed hitting outfielders.
It's a very crowded outfield. I mean, he's headed back to Las Vegas after hitting 352 there last year.
Yeah.
Which 352 in Vegas, you know, is it's a good year.
Yeah, even in Vegas.
Even in Vegas.
But Granderson and Bruce, obviously, are not going to be around forever.
Yes. Older jokers.
Cecchini could see some time at second base, I would expect. You know, if Neil Walker's back injury is a big X factor for the Mets this year.
Yeah.
Cecchini could get a lot of that playing time. Matt Reynolds could get that playing time. I expect them to be 50 players, like borderline between the first and second division.
Mm-hmm. Like guys who, to me, like a 50 guy is a guy who's a good regular while he's cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're having to decide, are we going to invest in this guy long term or not? You don't. That's
both of them have improved dramatically as they've risen. It's tough. And you talk to the Mets front office and they say, you're too light on these guys. You got to move these guys up. It's hard to know what to make of that sometimes.
Well,
but they do have high floors.
With Cecchini, the concern I've always had, like, okay, he's primarily been a shortstop, and we know that he's not going to push aside Ahmed Rosario. There's just no question on that.
Not only that, he just can't play shortstop.
But that's what I was going to come back to. The concern I have with him is defensively, how good can he be even slid over? You know, that's really the question I have is are we talking about a guy? Now, again, this is the Mets. This is not a team that if you can hit, they have shown a willingness to put you in the lineup, even if you're below average defensively. But not range-wise and all, I don't think that's going to be a concern. But with the throwing and all, is Cecchini a guy who can be a reliable defender at second or bouncing around a little bit, second, short, maybe a little bit of third as a utility guy?
or outfield potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think so. I think his arm is just a touch short, and his mechanics are not perfectly suited for shortstop.
I got a Josh Coleman. I found my PCL notes. I got a Josh Colemanter comp on his throwing motion this year.
It's very high over the top.
Yeah, and then because of that, he feels pressure to be quicker.
Yes.
And gets out of time, and that's why he's so inconsistent at third at shortstop. But on the right side of the infield, that is not a concern.
And that's an old scouting. Talking to scouts, you know, before when we try to learn from scouts as much as we can. One of the things that is a differentiator, and we say what makes a shortstop versus a guy who can't be a shortstop. One of the things about it is a shortstop is a guy who can throw from a variety of arm angles.
Yes. Correct.
And that's not Cecchini.
And Cecchini's a guy who throws from an arm angle. But second base, that works out a lot better because it doesn't. That is not as much of a drawback as it is when you're playing short.
That's a great call.
Yeah, he's led both of his past two leagues in shortstops by errors. So.
And so both he and Nimmo are a little bit of tweeners. If you had to put money on one of those guys being a regular, regardless of the Mets fit, mm-hmm. it's Nimmo, right? He seems like he has a little bit more chance to be a regular, especially if second base is a power position.
That's tough. I would say the infield value would probably. I think Nimmo has a higher ceiling with the bat, but.
I look at big league left-handers and left fielders, and I see Brandon Nimmo being a guy who's a perfectly cromulent left fielder these days, where his value might come almost as much from his defense, being a really good defender in left field and hitting for average, like a better fielding Michael Saunders. Like, there are guys like him where he's not a classic profile left fielder, but I feel like he has a shot there, whereas I feel like Cecchini, I just don't feel there's enough impact in the bat.
Yeah.
So, and I like that you rank Nimmo ahead of Cecchini.
And you get that from scouts.
Okay.
Scouts, they also comment on, it doesn't look like it comes natural for Cecchini. There's a lot of effort. That's kind of a criticism that some prospects get.
I think I also grade him, but, you know, the brother was a premium hitter in the lower minors and just wasn't athletic enough. The game, he had a lot of effort to his game, and I might be holding the sins of the brother against him,
again,
Dante Bichette, Bo Bichette fashion, which I criticize when I did the Blue Jays.
I mean, this is a fascinating family, and it's a family that you
it's
know.
It's a great baseball
it's
family.
It's a great baseball family.
I'm all in on the Cecchinis.
That you know, I mean, it's both an asset and it is, in some ways, I can see how scouts almost make it a drawback, though. You're talking about someone who's very well coached.
Right.
Who grew up in the game. You know,
I mean, his mom probably does forgotten more baseball than most people.
And you're talking about, because of that, I understand there's almost a little bit of reluctance, like, okay, how much of this is that he's always been a little bit ahead of everyone else because he's just been bathed in the game for so long. But as you said, the thing that does stand out is as he's moved up the ladder, he's also shown improvement in significant ways, which that's the thing. He's already passed a test that his brother never passed.
Right, hitting in AAA. You're right.
His brother basically destroyed A-ball, you know, batting average on base, and the concern with him, who was a third baseman, the concern always was, can he do it defensively? Probably not. Is he going to hit for any power? And the answer is he got to the upper levels of the minors, and it was like, no, he can't play third, and no, there is no power. If he tries to hit for power, the batting average goes away.
He was exposed, I believe, as they say in the movie, he was a sitting duck.
Whereas Gavin is a much more well-rounded, to me, tool set.
Yeah.
That kind of, and being, again, being a true up-the-middle player, that gives him a big edge over his brother.
Yeah, Guerin's 2013 was pretty loud, but just don't forget, he hit .350 in the Carolina
he
League.
Did.
With more walks and strikeouts. That was...
How many homers?
At the time...
He slugged .547, which was almost a 200 ISO.
Yeah.
A lot of triples.
19 doubles, 4 triples, 5 home runs in 63 games.
I remember at the time, he and Mookie Betts were viewed in a similar light in the Red Sox system. Tells you how things change.
It just tells you how important athleticism is in the game. That's just the bottom line. Now, the Mets do have other position players, Matt. I know I don't want to belabor it too much, but I like Thomas Nito.
Mm-hmm.
Catchers take a while. 2011 or 2012 draft?
2011.
2011, Thomas Nito, but then batting championship in the Florida State League. He's got some catch and throw ability. I mean, the Mets have done a nice job of bringing catchers along in recent years. He's yet another one. And then Desmond Lindsay is kind of your shoot-the-moon, high-ceiling athlete with physicality guy. I like both those guys. I also like a system that has guys like Matt Reynolds and TJ Rivera in the upper levels. They have cheap pieces if they have injuries. Both, I think that both those guys are capable fill-ins, reserves.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a position player that you really like that you wanted to expound upon a bit? Maybe Desmond Lindsay?
Yeah, Lindsay's the guy who deserves discussion. I mean, he is definitely a first division potential. He went out in a kind of a brief New York Penn League season because of his hamstring injury again, which is a major concern. But
yeah. In
terms of ceiling, it's a 60 ceiling at least.
There's some hitting ability here. He's not just an athlete.
He has primary skills and secondary skills. He can walk, he can run the bases, he can play center field.
He's got some power, got some twitch.
He does.
I mean, if he can't stay in center field, if the hamstring issue robs him of a half step, or it's the kind of thing where the Mets are like, you know, we don't want you to run as much. We're going to put you on a corner. He may have the bat to do that, right?
Yes.
I mean, I think you're pretty confident he'll have the bat to be a corner guy.
Yeah. And talking with the Mets, yeah, they're very confident. And people in the Penn League loved him, too. If you look at go back to our Penn League top 20, he's like the top position player or one of the top guys. Yeah, and I think we should also mention Thomas Sabucki and Justin Dunn as guys
right.
with...
Yeah, I wanted to move on to the pitching. Yeah. I just want to wrap up the hitters. But Desmond Lindsay is a guy like... I guess my baseline I keep using in the office is he's better than Jamai Jones. Jamai Jones is the number one prospect for the Angels. I'm ranking Desmond Lindsay on my personal 150 higher than Jamai Jones.
Agreed.
I just, not all number one prospects are created equal. And, you know, this is a loud grade on Desmond Lindsay in the book. 60 Extreme is a loud, high ceiling grade. I don't feel like we consider Desmond Lindsay in the industry the way we think about maybe a Daz Cameron or a Garrett Whitley. But if you're in a deep keeper league, I prefer Lindsay to both those guys. He's shown some ability to hit.
I agree.
You on board with that one, JJ? You on board with
that one? No,
just because those guys were first-round picks don't mean jack to me.
Again, and the other
same thing. Same draft class, I prefer Lindsay.
Same draft class, and the other thing about that is that when you get this far out, because, tools-wise, there's not a dramatic difference. Again, Daz Cameron, not trying to rail on Daz Cameron, but Daz Cameron, tools-wise, is not in a different stratosphere than Desmond Lindsay. And Desmond Lindsay,
he's in a lower stratosphere.
And Desmond Lindsay has shown a better ability to hit at the pro level so far than, now, again, there
I'd
are...
I'd still like him to be in full season ball.
I'd like to be full season ball, although he's a second rounder, not a first rounder.
Right.
There's, again, one of the JJ little JJ-isms, a second rounder who's not in full season ball in his first full year, a little different because there's a reason you fell to the second round.
That's right. That's
the
exactly
first rounder
right.
who doesn't, that's a concern because you were taken the first round. No one nowadays takes a first rounder because you're so raw that it's going to take a long time. Those are second, third, fourth rounders.
Unless you're Bubba Starling. So, yes. No, I agree. I agree completely. Let's move on to the pitchers, Matt, because the Mets have been very good at developing pitchers. That, I think, is one of the reasons why they drafted Justin Dunn and Anthony Kay, because it's like I just remember the Yankees doing this with David Oppenheimer where he said, you know what? Push comes to shove. We're good at drafting and developing pitchers. We have more confidence in that. So if two prospects are close, we should probably take the pitcher because we've had more success developing those guys. The Mets seem like they're kind of in that same boat. But Justin Dunn is unique. You did a little research on this, and it's just very hard to find another guy who was a college closer up until the last half of his draft season and was then drafted in the first round. So there must be something special there. That's why he gets an extreme in the book, right?
Yeah. You can find examples of guys who switched roles prior to the draft year, but never during the draft year, which Dunn did. Right. And there's still a lot of people in the industry who think reliever when they think Dunn. He hasn't shown he can get out left-handers consistently to their satisfaction.
Yeah.
He doesn't have but he does throw a changeup, and he does have one of the best fastballs and sliders already in the system.
Good place to start.
There is a front line. It's a quick arm.
That's what stands out to me.
Not a ton of mileage. I mean, there is a lot of growth potential. And I think, as you mentioned with the Mets pitcher development, having that in his sails works in his favor.
And the other thing to me that stands out is that I know Anthony Kay, things have not worked out like the Mets had hoped when they drafted Anthony Kay. You don't want it to be something where...
He's on a Steven Matz plan.
Right. You don't want it to be something where, we will look forward to seeing you on the mound at some point in the future. That's not what you're looking for. That being said, I still do like... I like when a team can take two college arms like that and kind of... two very different college arms in many ways and kind of spread the risk a little bit. That's to me... I like their draft from last year, partly because of that, even with Kay having the injury.
They really needed that injection of upper-level pitchers because, aside from Matt Harvey, most of the guys they've developed have been high school or trade. Noah Syndergaard, Zach Wheeler.
Yeah, great point.
You know, they don't have a track record for developing this particular demographic.
But Robert Gesellman is the high school demographic, and the development of him is a pretty good success story for them, Matt, because this is a guy who has been in top 30s in the past, but has never been in the top 10 because he never had a year like he had last year and never really showed that this was a guy who could be more than just a back-of-the-rotation guy. What did he do to get better last year?
Improved his secondary stuff. His strikeout rate spiked in the major leagues. He picked up the power slider that Dan Worthen teaches.
The Worthen slider.
Yeah.
I will say it's
essentially throwing a slider at as hard as possible.
At fastball velocities, yeah.
You had him number 14 coming into the year, which is a fairly aggressive ranking coming off the fact that, you know, he'd been good but not great in Double A.
He's never dominated the minors. His major league performance is an outlier. And it was focused against the Braves and Phillies. He faced them 6 or 7 times.
He made 7 starts. So
okay, 4 or 5 times.
That's an important caveat, I think.
In September.
I think it's important to note that you don't want to, and that's why you didn't overdo it with his ranking. You brought him up, but he's number 7. But his big league starts were at St. Louis. Well, not starts, big league outings. At St. Louis, Philadelphia, Washington, at Atlanta, at Washington, Atlanta, Philadelphia, Philadelphia. Yeah. So it was primarily built on 2 teams. On the Braves were playing better in the second half, certainly.
Phillies are playing worse.
But the Phillies are playing worse. And the last 2 starts were 13 innings. So he had 19 of his 35, you know, his 44 innings were against the Phillies, which was like Odubel Herrera, Cesar Hernandez, and a bunch of placeholders, basically. So so take that September stuff with the September performance with a grain of salt, but the stuff is what was probably most encouraging about that debut, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, especially
good velocity, good breaking ball velocity, good enough changeup. He's a starting pitcher.
That's a right-handed pitcher, JJ, who spins a breaking ball.
That's the John Manuel.
You gotta have it, and it doesn't seem to hurt that he's got some flow. If you're going to be a Mets pitcher, they seem to like the flow. It doesn't hurt. It didn't hurt Jacob DeGrom, and it doesn't hurt Syndergaard.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, he doesn't have to be a front of the rotation guy.
No.
Not for them. And it feels like he is ready to be a fourth or fifth starter, which
I think
like.
So. And just for the record, he had a labrum tear in his left shoulder that he played through last year, so he couldn't actually swing the bat.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of a fun little tidbit. Yeah, he still went up there anyway and swung the bat.
Still up there.
But he's better than some of the other guys, like the Marcus Molinas and some of these other back rotation guys.
His makeup and toughness are separators.
And the other thing is, again, the thing that does stand out to me about this Mets list is Marcus Molina, Anthony Kay don't make the top 10. And both of them for good reasons. You know, we're going to see Molina's back on the mound, but Molina basically for the AFL. But, you know, we want to see him back on the mound for a extended stretch. Anthony Kay, we're waiting for him to basically make his pro debut injuries. But those guys not being the top 10 does signify, again, a reminder of the Mets still, even with one of the best pitching staffs in baseball. And, again, the funny thing with that is I don't know what we can depend on Zach Wheeler at this point. But the reality is that
No one's coming through that door going, good luck, we're all counting on you.
Right. But
that's not happening with him.
But you have Zach Wheeler, who has been a legit dude, earlier in his career, kind of just like, oh yeah, he's another guy, we've got to figure out where he fits in and all that. You have a pretty loaded starting rotation still, and you have a significant number of upper level and lower level pitchers coming up behind them, and a number of guys who really do, if it all breaks right, are more than just back-end contributors. For a system that is of a contender that has made moves and that has been contending for the last couple of years, it's a pretty solid system.
Yeah, the legacy of their scouting department, that has made a change there. What Mark Tremuda is now the new scouting director. Tommy Tain is promoted to a vice president kind of level.
That's correct.
But so Tommy Tainis' legacy. I mean, obviously, he's still going to be very involved. Paul DePodesta's legacy from running their farm system for many years before he went to the NFL.
Took on an even bigger challenge.
Got the Mets to win a pennant. He said, "Like this is small fry. This is nothing. Let me go to the Cleveland stinking Browns." So there's a pretty good legacy there. It's a pretty decent depth. The other impact guy that we mentioned earlier, let's talk about Thomas Sopucky, Matt, because he is a guy who, again, Hudson Belinsky doing the Appy League was very impressed with Thomas Sopucky. Just on pure stuff, mm-hmm. He's another potential future six player.
Yes. You could go as high as seven on both of his primary pitches, fastball, breaking ball.
That's pretty loud stuff.
The changeup is not as refined because he's got the lower arm slot. Some of the notes are glowing. People saw him in the Appy League. You know, this is what a frontline left-hander looks like, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, good body.
And their performance, he had the highest strikeout rate of any pitcher in the short season ball this year.
I mean, it was really kind of like a Matt Moore-ish kind of debut with fewer walks. But he doesn't do it as easy as Matt Moore does.
No. The delivery has effort, and he finished the season on the shelf with a back injury or some back tightness or... Right. I forget how it's classified.
Like Blake Snell's another. These are guys who we think of as guys who were high school left-handers with big stuff who in rookie ball put up some really eye-popping strikeout numbers. And they both became big league rotation guys. And obviously Snell was our minor league player of the year. So Pucky's strikeout numbers are in that caliber of those
guys. Give me 20 starts in A-ball next year and I'll run them way up.
That's right.
He'll be in everybody's top 100.
Oh, absolutely. Right. He'll be top 50-ish. Because if he shows you the durability to pitch you 110 innings and 20 to 25 starts, if his stuff is what it has been, he's going to miss a lot of bats. Yeah, he's impressive.
And we got a question that was asking about another guy on this list, mm-hmm. PJ Conlon, who is, I would in some ways frame him as on the other end of the spectrum.
Yes.
PJ Conlon is a fascinating guy. ERA leader for the minors last year.
Minor league ERA champion.
He is the champion.
For his career, and it didn't have a whole, because he didn't give up a run in Brooklyn the year before. His ERA actually went up as he was the minor league ERA champ. That raised his career ERA, which is impressive. But 12-3, 1.47 in 159 minor league innings so far. Right there, let's just start with... impressive, wow, all that. That being said, this is a guy who does it with... Is there a 60 that you know...
You could put a 6 on the changeup, and his control is very strong. I get the sense from talking with scouts that reliever is the role they're most comfortable projecting him to. The best comp I got was J.P. Howell.
That's interesting.
That's a high-leverage reliever for a good team for multiple seasons.
Yeah, I mean, I think he is the kind of guy, J.J., that... we've talked about where it's easy to get fooled if you're just evaluating him on the numbers because low class A and A ball, short season balls, where you could dominate with command and you don't have to have great stuff. So the fact that he has a 1.47 ERA career in 159 innings doesn't tell you a ton. Like how he does it is more important than what he's doing at that level.
And the concern is if you can command and you have a changeup in A ball, there are a lot of hitters who... they literally, at that point, they're done. Because they just, you can go...
you're actually doing them a favor for their future development. I'm like, oh, that's how a good changeup goes.
But you can double up on a changeup on those guys, and it does not... you can double up, and the next time up, you can double up, and the next time up, you can double up.
Yeah.
And it's like, they just can't hit it. And that doesn't mean that he's going to hit this massive wall next year. Because, again, I like that he's a lefty. A lefty mm-hmm. with controlling a changeup... it's a lot of different story than a right.
But I love that J.P. Howell comp.
But that being said...
that's a good one.
That being said, these are the guys who, they go as they go up the ladder, especially Conlon's fastball is always going to be something that he can locate it well enough, but it's basically playing off the changeup rather than the other way around. Those guys have a tougher... as they get against more advanced hitters, that is a much tougher way to pitch than it is in the low minors.
We'll see if he can sit more 90 consistently in the bullpen. But right now it's 87,
88. I like the funk. There's a little funk to it too. Mm-hmm. A little crossfire, if I remember right. You know, it's a lot of things that add to the whole package. But
I like the fact that the Mets didn't have a first-round pick in 2015.
Correct.
But they found Desmond Lizzy in the second round, who they really like. David Thompson's interesting. They traded Max Botel for Big Leaguer, right?
Jay Bruce.
So Not terrible. They found Thomas Zupacki. Corey Taylor has been ridiculous for them as a pro.
Yep.
And he led Division I in ERA his last year, I believe,
out
of the bullpen.
They
for
love
Texas
ERA
Tech.
Leaders.
They sent him to the Fall League as a second year pro. So he's on the horizon for them.
Wait,
talking about Corey Taylor.
Corey Taylor, though. Wait, Corey Taylor.
Reliever.
You're thinking of the different Corey Taylor.
I thought I was thinking of the guy from Texas Tech.
Yeah, no. This is the Texas
this
Tech.
This is the Texas
this
Tech
the
guy.
Texas Tech
who
guy.
Had the 0-31 ERA in 57 innings in 2015.
Should have included it in that.
Yeah, I mean, like.
There it is. It's the first line.
Okay. Yeah, no.
Taylor,
I edited it.
Taylor recorded an 0-31
That's
ERA.
How the handbook works. You don't. I don't have to have all the answers. JJ doesn't have to have all the answers, and you don't. You want to talk about the hive mind?
It's a group
this
effort.
Is the hive mind right here. That's why, that's what, I could go on a big spiel about Baseball America, but we don't, none of us has to know everything. Some of us are absurd enough to try, but you guys are smart enough not to. But I like that draft class for the Mets, they didn't have a first round pick, they didn't have a giant pool. They just scouted, they just kind of out scouted everybody. Patrick Mazika's at your top 30. He could be a
like
guy.
Him.
I, you know, that guy is hit.
Is that the Conlon draft, too?
Yeah, it is the Conlon draft. 13th round.
So. Yeah.
I have to say it with a stupid fake Irish accent because I'm an idiot. So that's one of the reasons why I like their system a little bit better than I thought I did. I still, you know, that the 14 draft for the Mets, conversely, mm-hmm. is looking like a rough draft.
Is that
Conforto, I think I gave them an A anyway. But the rest of the draft class, Milton Ramos... Oh, man, moment of silence for Eudor Garcia. I love Eudor Garcia.
Don't write him off yet.
They had the PED suspension.
He's not in the 30, but...
Yeah, like I could hit at El Paso CC. But I don't think you ranked anybody else in the top 30 out of the rest of this whole draft class.
That's correct.
You know, so it's not a class that's gone well for them. So it was important, that I think, for them, that they had a really... I think they had some depth in that 15 draft, and I think they have the potential to have some real impact in that 16 draft. 2013 draft is another one that really kind of concentrated in Dominic Smith in the first round and then Luis Guillorme in the 10th round. Those are the top guys from the rest of that draft. They did trade Casey Meisner with some other kind of misses in that draft class. So they needed a deep draft in 15, and they got it, and I like the 16 draft.
And again,
as well.
The 16 draft, what's impressive about that is this is a team that was drafting late because, you know, again, they did have additional pick that helped.
Yeah, absolutely. So... Because we like Anthony Kay, despite the Tommy John surgery. Pete Alonso's a pretty interesting guy. Mm-hmm. Right first baseman, college first baseman, but he does have some big-time power.
Yep.
I was a little bit surprised by their college position player drafts after that, Blake Tiberi and Michael Paez. But you rank Colby Woodmansey, who they had to be stunned to get in the 5th round. All consensus, I would say, of short college shortstops. None of them had Coastal Carolina national champion Michael Paez ahead of Colby Woodmansey. I'll tell you, the Coastal Carolina team, their coaches are like, boy, we had Taylor Motter. We thought Taylor Motter was a dude and was going to get drafted high. He went in the 17th round. Michael Paez is not near the athlete Taylor Motter is, and he went in the 4th. It stunned them, and this is a national championship program. So they know players. They're pretty good at it, too. They were stunned Michael Paez went in the 4th round. But Colby Woodmansey, who was consensus better the whole year, I think people thought Colby Woodmansey had a chance to be the top college shortstop
again,
in the draft.
There was no consensus.
Right,
but
it wound
he
up
was,
being C.J. Chatham.
But he was in that group of, you know, it really did become, it was Eye of Beholder.
Yep.
And there were like 5-6 guys.
Yep.
And the funny thing about that is one of the things when there is that, when there's no, you know, you go back to the year before was a really good college shortstop draft.
Epic. And record setting.
And with that one,
Wisconsin's pretty good.
Yeah.
But there,
Alex Bregman too.
But there were the top two, but the thing about it is that you when there are those clear top guys, it's one of those things where no one, you know, you don't have this, well, we really Mikey White was the top guy on our board, or
right.
you don't get that kind of thing. The thing that every team we talk to about this year's, because they can legitimately do it, is if you're the Mets, you can talk about how those guys were the top shortstop on your board.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're the Royals and you take Creighton's, help me, John,
Nicky Lopez,
in like the, you know, in a later round,
hey, he's the top guy on our board.
You're the top guy on our board. And the thing about it is that can be you're not, they're not just blowing smoke, because again,
right.
there was no, this is the first round college shortstop in this draft.
That's right.
But there was so many of these guys who it's like, okay, well, we like this guy. I like, though, what the Mets did there because, yeah, I mean, would Man see where they got him? Again, yeah. C.J. Chatham, if you told me that he ends up being better than C.J. Chatham, will not stun me.
Absolutely. No, this is a pick 'em. I don't think anybody, there's not a board in Vegas probably that says top college shortstop for the 2016 draft. If there were, I would bet on it.
So, I'll take the field.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. We do have we had one other question from College Fan 03. Will Ahmed and Dominic Smith both start in Las Vegas, or do you think they might start Ahmed Rosario in Double A next year? What's your take there?
I think if he plays well in the spring, they'll bump him to Triple A. Give him as much upper level experience before.
Make Matt Reynolds your Triple A utility man?
That is the thing. If Cicchini and Reynolds are kicking around. Who else could potentially be there? I think those are the big two. TJ Rivera's not guaranteed a spot. They have a lot of infielders.
They do. They have a lot of infielders.
A lot of upper-level infielders. And
Philip Evans would be AAA ready, theoretically.
The thing about this is that...
Should have been Rule 5. They were hoping to clear some space.
Yeah, they didn't protect him.
That was one of the things when they didn't protect him. You look at that and you legitimately said, it's like, if he gets taken, the Mets can look at that and go... Okay, that actually makes the decision-making a little easier. It's going to be kind of tough to tell Philip Evans, hey, great year there, Eastern League batting champ. Right. That's some bad news for you. Try to do it again.
Yeah, seriously.
I think he'll be picking up outfield a lot more. I think that's going to be part of the solution.
But it is, again, they have also a lot of these guys, and not all of them are going to work out. Like, again, it does surprise me a little bit that Rafael Montero, who, not that we ever thought he was going to be a star or anything, but I did feel like that there was enough there to be a useful big league back of the rotation starter.
Yep.
And instead, I do wonder sometimes. I mean, the one concern you have with some of these guys who are going to be headed back to the same place, staleness can set in. I mean, it's something where that shouldn't be a long-term problem, you would hope. But the reality of it is that there is something where it is harder to continue to improve when you're blocked and you kind of have to stay at the same spot than it is if there's kind of a clear path for you. And that's a good problem to have, but the Mets do at the upper levels have guys who it's like, hey, we need you to do better than you did last year, but you did pretty good last year and you're going back to the same spot that you were last year.
Yeah. Yeah, Rivero, Nimmo, and Cicchini, 1-2-3 in the batting race in the PCL.
Yeah.
Not bad.
That, and literally they all could end up starting the season.
Yes.
That's crazy. They all could be back in AAA. Yeah. That's a good problem to have compared to teams where it's like, well, who's going to be our upper level guys?
This is a division. I wanted to wrap on this. This is a division of farm system extremes. You got the Braves, who are in contention to be the number one farm system. You got the Phillies, who are in contention for that. Not necessarily number one, but it's a good farm system. And they're rebuilding. You got the Nationals, who traded the guts of their farm system. Mm-hmm. You have the Marlins. Like, farm system? What's a farm system? Exactly. Why do we need this?
Farm system is just guys we haven't traded yet.
That's right. Where are the Mets? Are the Mets in the middle in this farm system, in this division? But it does feel like the Mets are the combination of contender, two straight playoff appearances, with a pretty decent farm system. The Braves hope to be a contender soon, but they were obviously not in 2016. The Phillies were not. So those teams have good farm systems for a reason, because they intended to have good farm systems. The Mets seem like the Nationals traded a lot of prospects for their big league team. Right. We'll see if it works. They still don't have a closer. Inauguration day, they don't have a closer.
And Victor Robles and Eric Fetty is a good one, too.
It's a very good one, too. And I think there are teams that would take that over Ahmed Rosario and Dom Smith. That's a discussion.
It is.
In fact, I think I might. I like Eric Fetty more than the average bear. But the Mets stand in the middle of this. I mean, like, it feels like they are a contender who should contend for several years, Matt. They feel like their window is not a short window.
The starting pitchers stay healthy, yes. No doubt.
Well, my thing with that is let's look at the Braves just for a second on this. The Braves have built a very impressive farm system. To me, when I look at the Braves, the best that they can hope to develop, because they're pitching heavy, and obviously they're going to use some of that pitching at some point in trade and all that. But the best you can hope is if the Braves, with all this pitching, develop into the Mets starting rotation and healthy. That's the only thing addendum I could add to it. I can't see how they could be better. They're not going to be
better. I agree.
They
will not be better.
They're not going to be better than the Mets.
What the Mets' best could be.
Than what the Mets' best is when they're all healthy. And again, you can say, but they haven't all been healthy at the same time and all that. I get it. But the reality of it is that, and again, hey, the healthy Mets rotation was in the World Series in 2015. So
it was ridiculous. I'm sorry, but the Mets' healthy rotation, when Harvey, Syndergaard, DeGrom, and Mats are all at full power, that's Death Star.
And the Mets' healthy rotation allowed them, let's be honest, look at that 15 lineup. That was not murderer's row or anything like that.
It wasn't profile.
There was a lot of limitations in that group, and they had injuries as well. I mean, but with all that, that pitching staff got them there.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think it's an encouraging thing if you're a Braves fan, because you say, this is an example of what an outstanding rotation can do. And if it means that we have guys at shortstop who's not really a shortstop, guy at second base who's maybe not really ideal second base, a guy at third base who can't bend over because of injuries, all these things, you can still make the World Series with that. But that being said, if you're the Braves, your aspiration is not to exceed that rotation.
Yeah.
You're dreaming that you hope. I mean, because again,
you have to be a more complete team, because you're not going to be better than the Mets on the mound.
And again, Noah Syndergaard is, when we talk about freaks of nature who's like, are beyond almost explanation, Noah Syndergaard to me, you can talk about a Rolls Chapman album, Noah Syndergaard's at the top of that list. There is no one else like him who can go out there and throw at basically peak closer velocity levels inning after inning.
Don't you expect that Noah Syndergaard is going to be the best right-handed pitcher in the major leagues in the next 3 years?
It's possible.
If healthy.
He was upset on Twitter that he got no Cy Young votes this year.
His Twitter game is pretty good.
It is very good.
I don't follow a lot of players anymore, but so I don't follow him, but I see him retweeting.
It's possible. Innings is going to be the threshold he has to cross to get there.
Yeah, to be like that. You know, he has to pitch like Verlander innings.
Yes.
And the concern about this is,
can
you do that when you throw a 100 mile an hour fastball and a 90, you know, and a 92 to 93 mile an hour slider?
He pitched through some bone spurs this year, so you like to see that.
Think we question the dude's toughness.
No.
But I do look at it and I say, like, again, what I'm trying to say with that is as good as the Phillies farm system, you know, and their rebuilding is going, as good as the Braves farm system is as they rebuild, their aspiration is not really at this point to me to exceed where the Mets are. It's to get there and be in that, which is fine. The reality is that, you know, the NL East has been a kind of a downtrodden, you know, division in many ways, because you've had these teams where we're going to play them. We should get 16 wins out of those games, something like that.
Right. There's usually been a team tanking. I don't think there is one right now, though. I think that division's on the way up.
Right. That's what I was going to say. But with that, it's the division on the way up. But I do look at it and I say, if I'm a Nats fan, I look at it with, okay, where are we going to be in 2018, 2019, 2020? On the Mets, I look at it and say, we still should be in that mix.
Mets are good. The Nats are like, are we still paying Jason Worth in those years? That's your first question. You know, Noah Syndergaard, 36 strikeouts, 17 hits allowed, and 11 walks in 26 postseason innings. He's been pretty good. I mean, he was awesome.
The only World Series win.
There's that. And he was also awesome in the wild card game against Bumgarner.
Yes.
He was fantastic in that game. So, and he can hit a little bit, too.
He stepped it up.
What's he got? 4 career home runs. So
something.
Yeah, so I'll give him that too. So good stuff. Any last minute Mets thoughts of yours, Matt? Besides the hashtag LGM.
No, that's it.
That's it. All right. So JJ, where do we go tomorrow? How do you think we're
tomorrow
gonna?
Tomorrow is Saturday.
Oh shoot! Yeah, we're not gonna.
Tomorrow
do a
is Saturday, and we will
what's
not.
What's our next?
Podcast
I'll be editing college preview issue. What's our next podcast for Monday? What's the next theme?
Probably Phillies or.
At some point, we're gonna do 24 hours of Braves. Yeah. JJ wants to do a
not 24 hours.
You just should go on Braves Reddit and just do an AMA. We've never done but Braves Reddit weirdly seems like super active. So I get a lot of tweets from them.
But no, I do think that we will probably save the Braves for the last in the East. We've knocked out the Marlins, yay, you know. But you know, Mets, Phillies, you know, and maybe it'll be Nats. Basically, it'll be Teddy and Ben's availability. It's going to be Nats or Phillies on Monday.
You know what? We'll do Braves first part next week because we'll actually have Nationals last because we got to wait for the college preview issue to be over. Teddy is otherwise occupado.
So yeah, if we have to go into Central, yeah, we will do Braves before that. So okay,
I agree. Thanks, JJ. Thank you, Matt, and thank you for listening to this Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.
This concludes our program. Want more in-depth baseball coverage? be a better fan, visit baseballamerica.com to get more comprehensive baseball coverage.